Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations, by Cook Inlet Region Incorporated, an Alaska Native corporation promoting social progress and economic development for people throughout the state, by the Tundra Times, keeping you up to date on statewide Native issues at 274-2512, and Humana Hospital Alaska, proud to be part of Alaska.
From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly. The worst oil spill in Alaska's history is a drama still in progress as government leaders and cleanup experts converge on Valdez to confront a major crisis in one of the world's richest environments. Good evening, I'm Corey Flintoff. Also tonight, Governor Steve Cooper told a newspaper in his hometown today he won't be running again. Some 265,000 barrels of crude oil have now spilled from the tanker Exxon Valdez, but state officials say the vessel, which hit a shoal outside of Port Valdez, has been stabilized. Claire Richardson reports that so far, no oil booms or other containment devices have been put in place.
Governor Steve Cooper arrived late this afternoon after circling the worst oil spill Alaska has ever seen.
We flew over the Exxon Valdez, took a look at the spill from the air, and then I'm going to come in and check with my DEC guys and see what's transpired since I took off in the plane.
Did you, when you looked at the tanker, what did you think? Had you ever seen anything like that before?
I sure haven't. It's the kind of thing that we've dreaded all these years, and now it's happened, and the best thing we can do is to do everything we can to clean it up. That's what we're worried about here at the moment.
Eyewitness reports revealed the oil had not been contained. Kim Hartman of Valdez was on one of the flights.
Exxon Valdez is roughly pointing up towards the entrance towards Columbia Glacier, anchored. The Exxon Baton Rouge was some ways off, probably a mile or so off, deballasting. There is no boom around either vessel. There are no skimmers out in the area. Basically, the slick is headed in a southwesterly direction. The biggest thing we noticed were the number of sea otters and sea lions in the area that in the middle of the slick. The buoy off of Bly Island Reef is kind of a traditional tourist spot for people to go out and see the sea lions on it. And of course, there are sea lions on it now, and the buoy is pretty much right in the middle of the slick.
According to National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration maps, the area of the spill is near sea otter concentrations, sea lion rookeries, and a Pacific herring spawning area. DEC official Tom McCarty says signs of oil on at least one beach, Bly Island, have already been spotted. All this information has kept Valdez Mayor John Devens busy and worried.
The city of Valdez is quite concerned with the protection of the environment right now, and we have, as I think most people are aware, collected taxes in the form of our Zone 3, which we have held, and these monies are available to provide some of the protection that is going to be needed. I've called and made the offer that we'll provide either the funding or manpower and or manpower. The meeting this evening is to get permission from the City Council to budget these funds for this purpose.
Now, these funds have been in litigation and are on appeal. Could you explain a little bit why you haven't used these funds?
Yes. Actually, the state of Alaska is appealing our use of these funds. However, this morning we did send a telegram to the governor's office and advised him that we may be forced to use these funds to help protect our environment.
Claire Richardson, if you could stay on the line with us for just a minute more, when will the Valdez City Council know when they're going to use these cleanup funds?
Well, they're meeting at 5 o'clock, Corey, to make a decision, and then hopefully they'll be able to move on it. Also, Exxon is holding a press conference at 6:30 this evening, since a lot of the national media and state media have arrived this afternoon.
I understand that since you put together our report tonight, you've had a chance to talk to the Coast Guard and to get a little better idea of how big the slick is.
That's right. It's now 5 miles long and 1,000 feet wide. And arithmetic, well, it's been going back and forth between barrels and gallons. Now the Coast Guard says 8.8 million gallons, which is roughly 265,000 barrels, have been spilt. And although it has not been boomed yet, they are hopeful that the transferring of oil to another tanker, the Baton Rouge, will start within the next couple of hours. And they say absorbent pads have been laid down by Alyeska terminal workers. However, they're still determining how to handle the spill.
I understand there was some issue of using chemical dispersants. Has any more been decided about that?
Well, they're making a decision whether to use them or not. I understand they made a sample testing of a dispersant because it changes because of the winds, tides, on different oil spills and oil slicks. Many fishermen are quite concerned. They say they don't want the dispersant used. So all that should come out later on this evening.
Great. Thank you very much. Claire Richardson reporting from Valdez. The oil spill happened in one of the most biologically rich areas of the Earth at a very sensitive time of year. Impacts on fisheries, birds, and marine mammals are only being guessed at right now. But most who've seen the spill agree they'll be major. Steve Heimel reports.
The wildlife of Prince William Sound is just coming out of its winter cycle. Crab larvae are rising to the surface, salmon fry are emerging, and huge schools of herring fed on by many marine mammals are just beginning to move into the sound. State Fish and Game area biologist Jim Brady, a member of the spill response team, says the impact on the fishery is a major concern.
Right now is the time that our crab are releasing their eggs, and we have juvenile larval crab in the waters, particularly in this area. This is a kind of a nursery area for shellfish. And it won't be long before we're seeing the emergence of fry, salmon fry, and of course the herring spawn. So timing-wise, this has a potential major potential threat to the fisheries resources in Prince William Sound.
The biggest worry is the herring fishery. Fishermen are hoping the oil will be gone by the time herring begin to spawn on the Sound's beaches and kelp beds and in kelp impoundments set up to aid in harvesting roe on kelp, a Japanese delicacy. Brady says the herring are on their way.
We've got herring fisheries that will be occurring in the Sound over the next 3 weeks or so, starting up within 2 or 3 weeks. And obviously it's a large concern for those fisheries.
But some fishermen say herring are already beginning to appear and to spawn in some of the inlets of the Sound. He says the vessel was more than a mile up the reef from a clearly marked warning buoy known as the Can.
She is laying in a direction pointing toward the Can. It's leaking oil out of the starboard tanks. There's oil on the aft tank toward the cabin. It looks like they tried to jettison the fuel overboard in an attempt to save the ship.
Lipscomb says he's seen tankers stray from the lanes before. He says when fishermen try to warn them, they turn off their radios. He says he thinks the prospects for this year's herring fishery are pretty well shot.
It looks like our season's gone. It's tragic.
Ricky Ott, a marine biologist who's now a commercial fisherman, was also out flying over the tanker and spill. She says she saw a lot of wildlife already trying to cope, including stellar sea lions on the warning buoy itself.
There was three sea lions hauled out on the Can, and they were completely surrounded by the spill. There's also, we saw a small school of herring as we flew in. The school was over by Alice Bay, which is on the en route into Cordova. There was eagles and stuff that were in the water feeding. As there's sea lions scattered throughout the area now that will become more concentrated as the herring mass to spawn. In another 2 weeks or so, we expect the sea otter population to be migrating out from the Cordova area where it overwinters into the Prince More, into the Prince William Sound area, and the area that they hang out on is Knoll's Head. We did see a humpback whale in the slick this morning when we flew to. He was spy hopping, no doubt trying to figure out how the heck to get out of there.
Ott says more wildlife will move in as the herring arrive. She says prospects for sea otters and other marine mammals who become soaked in the oil are just about hopeless.
There's no question that their fur would be coated and they would lose their insulation and die. I mean, there's no question about it. up here, there's just not the amount of number of people that you can mobilize to clean animals up, and cleaning doesn't really work very well anyway. They get pretty stressed out. When they're preening and grooming, they ingest the oil, and so they're ingesting it, and also it destroys their insulation property of their fur. So there's no question that any marine animals in this bill would pretty much be history.
A number of animal lovers and wildlife experts say they're going to mount a bird and marine mammal rescue effort anyway. None of the fishermen spoken with today thought much of the explanation that the tanker was maneuvering to avoid icebergs. Gordon Lipscomb and others say they saw no sign of any icebergs big enough to interfere with a huge tanker anywhere around.
The icebergs we observed I don't think they'd be even been critical to a ship of that size. They weren't, the ones we flew over were very small, very small.
For the Alaska Public Radio Network, I'm Steve Heimel.
Among those responding to the Valdez spill are the Interior Department's Pam Bergman and Everett Robinson Wilson of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The two are rapidly becoming experts in assessing and rehabilitating wildlife affected by oil spills. Bob King reports from Dillingham.
Bergman and Robinson Wilson will be assessing the Valdez spill and will make recommendations about the cleanup and rehabilitation of birds and other wildlife based on a specific set of criteria. The response guidelines include assessing the number of animals impacted by the spill, their chances for recovery, even the potential risk to would-be rescuers. It's a new process, according to Pam Bergman.
Yes, the guidelines, as I said before, were just adopted by the Alaska Regional Response Team in December 1988, and in fact, I had just come back. It was in mid-February from doing a presentation to the International Oil Spill Conference in San Antonio about developing those guidelines so that other regional response teams around the country could benefit. They were just recently put in place, and they're the only ones like it in the country.
Though the guidelines are new, this is the second time that they've been used this month. Their first test came 3 weeks ago when fuel leaked from the grounded cargo ship Swallow near Dutch Harbor. Hundreds of birds were killed by that spill, and despite a cleanup effort, only 8 birds were saved. Even so, Bergman says the Swallow experience showed that the guidelines worked.
What this process showed us was that with those guidelines in place, we could come onto a scene where there are oiled birds or oiled wildlife involved, and we can make a recommendation in a very timely manner to the Coast Guard about what needs to be done. And in the case of a recommendation where we feel it's important to go up and set up a center like we did, that we can do that in a short period of time and collect the dead birds as well as the live birds and do the best that we can with their rehabilitation.
The Dutch Harbor spill, though, was only a fraction of the amount of oil released by the grounding of the Exxon Valdez. The current spill should give the new guidelines their most rigorous workout yet. Meanwhile, in Dutch Harbor, the Coast Guard was in the midst of removing fuel from aboard the Swallow when the Valdez spill occurred. Earlier this week, the Coast Guard successfully burned off the fuel remaining aboard another Japanese cargo ship grounded near Akutan. In Dillingham, I'm Bob King.
Possible contamination from lead zinc ore is the issue in Skagway, and last night the companies that handle the ore held a public meeting there. They were responding to an order from the State Department of Environmental Conservation requiring them to find out how much ore dust their operations leave in the soil, water, and air. As Steve Williams reports, the big question now is how far the companies will go in cleaning it up.
The data revealed nothing new. Consultants for Bowhead Equipment, Yukon Alaska Trucking, and Kura Resources all found that lead levels have gone down since a preliminary cleanup took place last fall. The question on the minds of many at last night's meeting was, what about the harbor? None of the three companies, or White Pass, which released its own report earlier this winter, want to touch the contaminated sediments beneath the ore terminal dock, which have been building for decades. But DEC may not accept the company's plans to let the sediments lie. Dick Stokes is the agency's Southeast Regional Manager.
I think there are two real weaknesses to the approach, and one is that it takes a long time to naturally heal, and there certainly are contaminated biological species out there at the moment. The other weakness is it will limit what can be done in the harbor, at least in the contaminated areas of the harbor. projects that would require dredging, particularly, may be curtailed.
Stokes expects to rule on the sediments issue this summer after more testing to see if recent improvements at the terminal have reduced the amount of lead dropping into the harbor. Cleanup decisions on other hotspots near the waterfront and on the White Pass Railroad right-of-way will come April 2nd. In Skagway, this is Steve Williams.
It was bad enough when an emergency closure shut down pollock fishing in the central and western Gulf of Alaska yesterday. Now, Kodiak processors are outraged over the news that many of the fish caught were simply stripped of their eggs or roe and then dumped overboard. Lainey Welch has the story.
The Gulf pollock quota this season was just 60,000 metric tons when a Seattle-dominated factory trawler fleet entered the Gulf and quickly scooped 37,000 metric tons. The pollock fishery was shut down months before anyone anticipated. To make matters worse, Kodiak processors discovered a good portion of the pollock they would have turned into fillets or surimi was simply stripped of their valuable roe and dumped overboard. Eagle Seafood's Reed Wasson.
On an incredible scale. I mean, they took more than half of the whole year's quota in a couple of weeks and threw the cartridges away and kept the roe, and basically shut down all the pollock operations in Kodiak for the rest of the year.
Boat owner Dave Harville says if a vessel is roe stripping only, it can run through 3.5 times the amount of fish each day than if it was utilizing the entire animal.
What they have done, they've come and they have wasted a resource, 37,000 tons of resource, to get approximately 4% by weight, and they have shut down an entire community. What's happened is the outside interest to put the Gulf of Alaska out of the business.
Wasson says the rape of the resource occurred out of desperation.
The overcapitalization of the factory trawler fleet has put them all in a position where they can no longer afford to be gentlemen. They're desperate. Unless there is regulation, they're going to do whatever they have to do. It's a situation where the industry can no longer regulate itself.
Kodiak processors estimate at least 60% of the pollock resource was taken from shore-based facilities by the Seattle factory trawlers. Meetings are taking place now to assess the economical impact and to begin a plan of attack. Dave Harville says Kodiak interests will appeal to the North Pacific Fishery Management Council to keep factory trawlers out of the Gulf of Alaska and in the Bering Sea where they belong. Harville says they'll also try to get regulations imposed, giving shore-based operations priority access to all the fish in the Gulf.
What they've done is they've fired us all up, and we are now, we're going to fight for our resource, and my prediction is that we're going to get our resources, and they're going to wish to Christ they'd never done what they did to us.
The North Pacific Fishery Management Council is scheduled to discuss the fate of Kodiak's pollock fishery at their June meeting. But Kodiak industry members say they won't be stopped from bringing their case to council attention in April. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
Governor Steve Cooper ended the speculation today. He's not running for governor or any other office in 1990. Cooper's refused to talk to reporters about his decision, granting only one interview to the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. The governor's sudden conversion to lame duck status has changed the political playing field, both for the 1990 governor's race and the rest of the 16th legislature. Peter Kenyon reports.
The only reason put forth by Cooper for choosing to be a one-term governor is that he doesn't feel he can get his agenda through the legislature if he has to worry about running another statewide campaign. That agenda, as outlined to the News Miner, includes a long-term budget plan for the state, his education endowment, beefed up foreign trade, and help for village social ills. Cooper's director of constituent relations, Laurie Roberts Scandling, says this was not a sudden inspiration, but a carefully thought-out move.
And frankly, the decision was made a long time ago. This wasn't something that he bandied around as a possible yes or a possible no. His mind was made up some time ago. And why he timed it for this week, for this day, for that hour is a personal thing from him, and I don't know the answer.
Someone Cooper's staff tried to talk him out of it, says Scandling. One of Cooper's closest advisors, Revenue Commissioner Hugh Malone, says he's disappointed because the administration was just hitting its stride.
It takes a pretty pretty close to 2 years, I think, for a governor and for an administration to take hold in office. That certainly takes over a year. And so I think that, you know, Cooper is turning into a pretty good governor, and I think that what he has learned and the things that he started would be valuable to the people of Alaska if he would seek another term.
Malone says he takes Cooper at his word when he says he's dropping out of the race to devote more time to his top issues. Not everyone agrees that this is the way to do it, though. Republican Party Chair Jim Crawford says, as we heard from the Democrats all through Reagan's second term, a lame duck is a dead duck. House Speaker Sam Cotton says it's certainly an unusual way to try and increase your political effectiveness, but the Eagle River Democrat warns against assuming that this governor will be weaker because of this decision.
As far as what's going to happen down here, it's a lot different than a lame duck legislator. Part of being a legislator is understanding you're going to have to be dealing with your colleagues for years to come. And so if you're a legislator and people know you're a lame duck, well, then your effectiveness goes down pretty rapidly, I think. Whereas if you're the governor, I don't think it doesn't automatically move one way or the other, but I don't think it has the same downward motion that with the legislator.
Cotton and others agree that Cooper will be free of some political inhibitions, but they point out that bucking popular opinion has never bothered this governor much anyway. And even though he might not be running, he'll be dealing with a lot of legislators who are. But there is a theory that the most productive part of a governor's tenure is the last 2 years of the second term, and there's only one way to make that moment come any sooner. The other main focus of speculation is if Cooper isn't the 1990 Democratic gubernatorial candidate, who is? Jim Crawford didn't hesitate. He thinks this all but gives the Democratic nod to Bill Sheffield. That may be wishful thinking on the part of Republicans who believe Sheffield would be an easy target, but the former governor's name does keep popping up on candidate lists. Crawford refused to pick a Republican frontrunner, but he waxed enthusiastic over Senator Frank Murkowski, calling him a first-class executive, quote, probably a stronger executive than a legislator. Other GOP hopefuls include Senator Arla Sturgiluski, Jim Campbell, and Senator Jack Coggill. Though only Campbell has actually announced his candidacy. Other names include, on the Democratic side, Lieutenant Governor Stephen McAlpine and possibly legislative leaders. Speculation is focused on Ben Grusendorf, although he hasn't publicly expressed any interest in the job. Speaker Sam Cotton said he'd like to see some poll numbers about his own chances, but says most legislators will probably be putting out similar feelers. And the political grapevine has it that the likely Democratic frontrunner, at least at this point, is former Anchorage Mayor Tony Knowles. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
Labor analysts say the improvement is fragile, but they're sticking with predictions that Alaska's job market is gaining strength. Roseanne Smith reports new unemployment figures are at an 8-year low.
New jobs in the mining and oil and gas sectors of the economy tugged February's unemployment rate a full percentage point lower than this time last year. Statewide, that means about 3,000 more people are at work compared with 1988. State labor analyst Holly Stinson says about a third of those jobs are in mining. The largest gain, 600 jobs, was recorded at the North Slope as oil development expanded.
Things are better, but they're just a little bit better. And it's a fragile recovery, and it could certainly be derailed quite easily. It's not a boom, but it is a recovery from the recession.
Stinson says outlying areas such as Dutch Harbor and Kodiak also reported lower unemployment rates. A brisk bottom fish industry that's keeping some processors busy year-round is a factor. And Stinson says the state's largest city posted a bigger drop in unemployment than the state overall.
Anchorage unemployment rate is doing better than the statewide. It's down. Its February rate for the Anchorage borough is 6.9%. It was 8.3%, so it's seen a bigger drop even than statewide.
In nearby Matsu Valley, however, unemployment remains near 20%, and even though statewide figures are improved over this time last year, officials say the rate is still 4 points higher than February's average nationwide. In Anchorage, I'm Roseanne Smith.
In Dillingham, there's a growing controversy over the school superintendent's salary and benefits. The school board wanted to increase the superintendent's benefits when he took on the additional job of principal, but it seems to have ballooned to something that the school board never envisioned.
Bob King reports.
The idea was to save money by combining the jobs of school superintendent and principal. In return for the superintendent's added workload, the school board wanted to add $30,000 to his retirement account. It still would be a lot cheaper than paying a principal's salary. But through what the board calls a misunderstanding, the total amount of the package ballooned to almost $56,000. And instead of retirement benefits, Superintendent Henry Kilmer received cash. After taxes, Kilmer netted $40,000, with retirement benefits paid on top of that. It's angered many, among them school board member Jackson McCormick, who says he and the public were misled by other school board members.
I asked him if Henry Kilmer was paid any extra for being principal. Shirley Wiggins said, absolute, not one cent. And Shirley, Sally Smith backed it up by saying, absolutely not.
Kilmer stands by the wording of the minutes of the meeting in which the money was approved. Those minutes and an identical contract addendum were both approved by the school board, but don't mention any amount or the $30,000 cap the school board says they intended to place on the compensation. The minutes describe the compensation only as a net amount equal to back retirement years. Those words, however, are apparently Kilmer's own. A secretary typed the minutes from Kilmer's handwritten notes. Further complicating things, a former board member now says, while the compensation was discussed, it was never formally approved during that meeting. The meeting, though, was never recorded. So far, the school board has not proposed any way to try to correct the misunderstanding. Kilmer says he will negotiate with the board, but he already has the money in hand, and the long-term benefits for him could be even greater. The $50,000 will count as salary when the state retirement system calculates his future retirement payout, and the bonus will increase his eventual benefits by 21%. Originally intended to save the district $45,000, the savings now amount to only $9,000. And teachers say for that, they'd rather have a full-time principal. The administration disputes their claims that morale and discipline have suffered without a principal, but McCormick says the savings haven't been worth the cost.
Absolutely not. The morale of this school is low. There's no supervision, and the kids are just horrible the way things are going on here in this school, and I want it cleaned up.
McCormick has taken his complaints to the district attorney's office. So far, they've declined to comment. Meanwhile, the public will get to vote on whether to recall the school board in early May, a recall that stems from the controversy over Kilmer's added pay. Many are upset that while the rest of the schools were tightening their belts, the school superintendent was getting a $50,000 bonus. In Dillingham, I'm Bob King.
And that's Alaska News Nightly for this Friday, the 24th of March. We had reports tonight from Claire Richardson of KCHU in Valdez, Bob King of KDLG in Dillingham, from Steve Williams of KHNS in Haines, and Lainey Welch of KMXT in Kodiak, from Roseanne Smith of KSKA in Anchorage. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage, and Peter Kenyon from Juneau. Chris Badalek runs our technical operation, and Diana Derby is our engineer. I'm Corey Flintoff.
Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations, by Charter North Hospital, providing treatment for mental health and addictive disease, and the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, promoting quality Alaskan seafood in the domestic and international marketplace. This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network. Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations, by National Bank of Alaska, proud sponsor of the Iditarod and all that's Alaskan, and the Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, promoting quality Alaskan seafood in the domestic and international marketplace.
From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly. The Exxon Valdez oil spill has begun taking its toll on the environment, as high winds today hampered cleanup efforts and helped the 100-mile square oil slick wash over islands and beaches in its path. Good evening. I'm Corey Flintoff.
We'll have a look tonight at some of the environmental consequences of the Exxon spill, angry reaction from the governor, and a non-committal approach from federal emergency managers. The environmental damage that everyone's been dreading from the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Prince William Sound has begun. Oil has been seen washing up on beaches as far as 35 miles from the vessel, grounded on a reef near the entrance to Valdez Arm. Stiff winds this morning drove waves in the Sound to a height of 7 feet, causing the stricken vessel to pivot around about 12 degrees on the rocks and pulling loose the oil containment boom that surrounds it. The winds kept helicopters and most other aircraft on the ground this morning, and that prevented efforts to spray dispersants on the oil. It seems a helicopter is needed to guide the C-130 aircraft that do the spraying. Some of the oil booms that were set out to protect beaches were also reported damaged by the winds, and two pregnant women from the native village of Tetitlec were evacuated this afternoon because of fumes from the spill. Steve Heimel has more.
As the winds calmed, planes were able to get up and survey the spill damages so far. As predicted, the oil is hitting beaches now, and while few reports of dead wildlife have surfaced, there were a couple of human victims of the spill. Two pregnant women from the native village of Tetitlec across Bly Island from the spill complained about the oil fumes and the smoke from Exxon's burning of the oil and were evacuated to Valdez. The winds have generally been blowing the slick away from Tetitlec and have carried oil beyond where computer models said it would go. Bruce Baker of the State Fish and Game Department was not surprised.
I think it's safe to say at this point the spill is so large and the measures have been limited enough to date that there's going to be a lot of oil reaching beaches. It's already begun to.
Winds are carrying the oil to the west, where it will eventually move out to the Gulf of Alaska through Montague Strait, oiling a number of islands on the way by.
It's been heading pretty much from northeast to southwest from the point of impact. And so for now, anyway, we're expecting Knight Island and eventually Montague Island and the islands to the southwest, possibly, of Knight Island being struck.
Engineer Steve Willingham of the Department of Environmental Conservation called the beaches of Eleanor Island hammered with oil. Generally, he says, the northeast-facing beaches are affected. He said he also saw loose booms in the water, apparently blown away from the cleanup effort by high winds. DEC expects Exxon to put cleanup crews on those shores. Bruce Baker says the most critical area affected so far is Naked Island, a prime habitat.
But we're looking at extremely important Pacific herring spawning areas. We're looking at large numbers of seabird colonies. And we're looking at some marine mammals in that area. So it's a very important area to fishermen, and it's very important for marine, for seabirds and marine mammals as well.
For APRN in Valdez, I'm Steve Heimel.
Saying there's absolutely no excuse for having an unqualified officer in charge of the Exxon Valdez when it went aground, Governor Steve Cooper today said the Exxon should pay for 100% of the damage caused by its oil spill, including compensation to fishermen. Peter Kenyon reports.
Although state officials have muted their criticism of Exxon somewhat while cleanup efforts are being coordinated, it didn't take too many questions from reporters to bring Governor Cooper's frustration to the surface. He said it's obvious the industry believed its own story that a massive spill would probably never happen and didn't have the equipment on hand to deal with the accident. But what angers Cooper even more is the failure to use what equipment there was.
Of course, the excuses don't count. Performance counts. There was a barge that would have been used to put crude into. The barge was damaged by high winds some months ago. It was not repaired. Apparently, the result of that was such that most of the equipment that was there to be deployed in a situation like this could not be deployed. However, nobody was notified of that.
Cooper appeared most concerned by reports from Valdez that high winds were shifting the Exxon Valdez around on its precarious perch. The state's number one priority, he said, is to try and prevent any more of the 900,000 barrels of crude still on board the supertanker from fouling the Sound. The governor said he'll let the lawyers fight over the money later, but he made his own position clear more than once.
I believe that the industry should pay for all of it, 100%, including taking care of the fishermen whose seasons may well be ruined by this spill.
Besides the apparent damage to the state's efforts to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling, Cooper was reluctant to talk about specific oil issues that may suffer politically because of the spill. But he said that people may be a lot more suspicious of industry claims that they can operate safely in fragile environments. And he suggested that this environmental disaster may spawn a whole new generation of ecological activists in the state.
People in the state of Alaska, which is the place that I'm most concerned with, are going to be a great deal more active in terms of their understanding of what kind of constraints, environmental constraints, have got to be put on the industry. This is going to cause damage for a lot of years in a lot of different ways. I think in terms of the federal issues, whatever issues there are in Washington, D.C. that relate to the oil industry, is going to make things a lot worse, including ANWR and including any other issues that we have there. It's a political disaster.
Cooper's been invited to meet with President George Bush next Saturday, and the governor says he'll be discussing the oil spill and the ANWR effort. Cooper may also bring up the issue of drilling in Bristol Bay, which Alaska has been fighting for years, so far without success. For APRN in Juneau, I'm Peter Kenyon.
An attorney with the Federal Emergency Management Agency has cast doubt on whether the agency can recommend that President Bush declare Prince William Sound a federal disaster area. The story from Joel Southern in Washington.
Mike Hirsch in FEMA's Office of the General Counsel does not think the 11 million gallon oil spill from the Exxon Valdez will qualify for disaster assistance. Agency officials were scheduled to meet late today with staffers of Governor Cooper's Washington office and Senator Frank Murkowski's office to discuss the matter. Cooper's people also had their doubts about getting a disaster declaration, and FEMA's Hirsch confirmed those doubts.
Public Law 100-707, which became effective November 23rd of 1988 when the president signed it, redefines the term major disaster to authorize the president to declare major disasters only in response to natural catastrophes or fires, floods, or explosions.
Hirsch says the disaster law also redefines the term emergency to address any situation where federal aid is needed to save lives or to protect property, public health, and safety. And while the governor has declared Prince William Sound a disaster area, Hirsch says it might be difficult for the president to do the same.
For a major disaster declaration under the emergency title of the legislation, of the amended legislation, there's a much more limited range of assistance that can be brought to bear, and the theme of that that Title V of the amended legislation indicates that first you look to other federal response authorities that are available, and if there are other federal response authorities available that can be brought to bear to respond to a situation, then the president wouldn't declare an emergency.
That doesn't mean FEMA will flatly reject Cooper's request. By law, Hirsch says FEMA must still review the request. And so far, Hirsch and others at FEMA claim they haven't yet received Cooper's formal request. Hirsch says, though, the request would go first to FEMA's Washington State office in Seattle. Asked if there's any precedent for declaring an oil spill a disaster, Hirsch says he doesn't know of any. There was an inland oil spill in Pennsylvania last year caused when an Ashland oil tank collapsed into the Ohio River.
My recollection may be wrong, but I believe that the governor didn't even request a disaster declaration there. If he did, it certainly wasn't declared. If there was a disaster request, it wasn't made. No declaration followed.
Hirsch said Ashland Oil admitted responsibility in the episode and said it would pay for the damage. Exxon Shipping Company President Frank Iorosi has told fishermen and local residents repeatedly the company plans to compensate them for any losses from the Exxon Valdez accident. Hirsch says that could play a role in FEMA's review of Cooper's disaster request.
It certainly would be a significant indication from Exxon, and perhaps would suggest that there would be less of a need for a federal response than there might otherwise be if there was nobody who was willing to accept responsibility up front.
For Alaska Public Radio, this is Joel Southern in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to Alaska News Nightly from the Alaska Public Radio Network. Still to come, facing the problems of lead contamination in Skagway's harbor. Up next, the economic impacts of the Exxon spill on Valdez. As hundreds of people from the oil industry, state and federal officials, environmentalists, fishermen, and the media all converge on Valdez, the town's experiencing a mini economic boom. As Claire Richardson reports, though, it's not without its headaches.
It seems every phone number you dial in Valdez is busy. The hotels are full and small restaurants have lines. And you want a car? Forget it. Gail Tadell of Avis describes some of the 30 vehicles she had rented by Sunday morning.
Minivans, from little Corollas, mid-sized cars, full-size. We are getting some big vans, but they are already spoken for.
Job Service put out a call for applications on Saturday for hotel maids and other support services. So far, 95 cleanup crew members have been hired, 60 by VECO and another 25 by NORCOM. Exxon President Frank Iarossi says an additional 25 local workers will be hired every day as the cleanup swings into high gear. And with oil expected to wash up on numerous beaches, there will be plenty of work. ERA helicopters brought in 5 additional choppers, and jet fuel is being transported to Valdez every day. The runway resembles one at a busy metropolitan airport, with huge cargo planes and dozens of helicopters, jets and small planes landing and taking off hundreds of times a day. And, of course, this disaster has overshadowed the memorial of the devastating earthquake that destroyed the old town of Valdez in 1964. Museum curator Marnie Forbes says the turnout for the events have been dismal.
I think so. I think it's kind of out of sight, out of mind sort of thing right now. It's the initial disaster. It's taking over a remembrance of a previous disaster. It's kind of ironic that it happened so close to one another. But, yes, I think it has definitely had an impact on our attendance and remembrance. We only had 25 people to Friday night's lecture program, but the school attendance has been pretty good. Of course, you've got the captive audience sort of thing. But other than that, it did definitely affect our Friday night program.
While money is to be made now, it's just a drop in the bucket compared to the potential losses as a result of the spill. Mike Chase has been hired by different media groups to take them out to the spill aboard his boat. While the money is good now, Chase is worried about the summer and what he expects to be the nosedive in tourists and fishing charters.
I don't think that we're going to see near the tourists here this summer who want to go fishing, primarily because they've heard about the oil spill out there. And why should they go to Prince William Sound and catch polluted fish when they can go to Seward and catch pristine fish?
I'm Claire Richardson in Valdez.
It sounds almost anticlimactic, but there is a second oil spill in progress in Alaska right now. The Seattle-based crab vessel Terminator ran aground yesterday on St. Paul Island in the Pribilofs. The crew's been taken off the vessel, now sitting about 50 yards offshore. It's leaking diesel fuel, part of the 30,000 gallons it has on board. But high seas are pushing swells across the decks and preventing any further action. The Terminator is owned by Comet Enterprises of Seattle. With us on Alaska News Nightly for a look at another disaster, the earthquake that shattered Valdez in south central Alaska 25 years ago. Up next, dealing with lead contamination in Skagway.
The companies involved in Skagway's ore haul presented their testing results and cleanup plans at a public meeting last Thursday night. Steve Williams was there and has this report.
State environmental officials say some of the information may be inaccurate. DEC spokesman Dick Stokes says faulty sampling methods were used by company consultants testing the soil.
Because of that, the values reported earlier are not comparable to the EPA numbers that we have to use to set cleanup levels.
But Stokes says the data can be easily corrected to be used later to set cleanup levels. So far, environmental officials have talked about numbers ranging from 500 to 1,000 parts per million for lead. While the findings were questioned on a scientific basis by state and federal officials, local residents were concerned about broader issues. Skagway City Councilman Don Levine.
The big questions I have is the marine sediments in the boat harbor. Capping them might be a way to prevent them from being disturbed, but that precludes any sort of dredging activity that might take place, whether it's white passes, plans to put in a passenger dock, or future plans, whatever, down on the waterfront. I also think that another round of blood tests in the fall, after we've had the south wind to stir everything up again over the season, would be a good way to determine on the blood levels if they are elevated or if they're being lowered, to see if the objectives in the cleanup are being met.
The contamination of Skagway Harbor is hardly mentioned in the cleanup proposal presented by Bowhead, Kura, and Yukon Alaska Transport, the three companies involved in the current ore haul. Bowhead attorney Charles Blumenfeld probably best summed up his client's feelings toward the issue when he said, quote, "We don't know where the lead came from." But the report does point a finger at White Pass, saying most of the lead and zinc was deposited on the ocean floor before 1982, when White Pass was operating the ore terminal. The report recommends that the sediments be left in the harbor, suggesting they'd be naturally covered over time. But Stokes of DEC says there's two problems with that approach.
And one is that it takes a long time to naturally heal, and there certainly are contaminated biological species out there at the moment. The other weakness is it will limit what can be done in the harbor, at least in the contaminated areas of the harbor. Projects that would require dredging, particularly, may be curtailed, certainly limited. It would certainly cost more money.
Another concern for cleanup is the railroad tracks. White Pass hauled lead, zinc, and other heavy metals through Skagway for more than 50 years, and some of the soil along the line is contaminated with levels as high as 25 times the amount considered safe for industry. White Pass has offered to cover hot spots with crushed rock, but the state says some of it may have to be removed. White Pass official Marvin Taylor.
The disposal of any material is a very serious thing because there's no disposal site in Alaska where that dialogue is going on. I'm sure some covering will be permitted. I'm sure that there's about three or four spots where removal will be required. And you may have noted we have a crusher working in the vicinity right now, crush gravel for that purpose.
An issue that has been raised before by local residents resurfaced at Thursday night's meeting. Is one round of blood tests enough to determine if the people here are at risk? Stokes says more blood testing may be done this summer.
And I think if there are a number of Skagway citizens that, in spite of what I'm convinced is good clinical information, if there's still a good number of Skagway residents that have high anxiety and want their blood tested, I don't want to rule out the fact that the state will at least consider that.
Stokes, who chairs the Lead Steering Committee, says his group will meet again on April 5th. He says some decisions on cleanup will be announced at that meeting. In Skagway, this is Steve Williams.
If it weren't for the Exxon Valdez disaster, today's big story probably would have been a remembrance of another Good Friday disaster, the 1964 earthquake. That disaster took just 4 minutes, 25 years ago, to wrench downtown Anchorage into a twisted heap of rubble. From that rubble has come a new city, a new skyline, and what could be an infinitely greater hazard. This next report is part of a series called On Uncertain Ground, and what it shows is that while memories are still fresh, preparedness for the next quake is limited at best. In our first story, Robert Hawk reports on the sights and sounds of March 27, 1964.
25 years ago this month, Anchorage was a disastrous mess. Having been struck by the biggest earthquake ever measured in North America, the second biggest in history. Chances are, even without a special museum downtown, nobody who was in Anchorage then will ever forget the Good Friday earthquake. The Alaska Experience Theater features a simulation of an earthquake for the tourists, much milder than the real thing, and they have a recording of the actual sound of the 1964 disaster. This tape was made by a legal secretary in a downtown office. She left the recorder running as the earthquake began. The tape recording stopped suddenly when the power failed, but the ground kept shaking. Al Hanisch recalls details about that March 27th. A retired fuel truck driver, Hanisch was just finishing his day's work near the fuel tank farm at the Anchorage port when the quake hit. Hanisch says the ground was shaking so hard he couldn't walk, but he could see, and the first thing he noticed were the fuel storage tanks on the hill above him.
And I looked at those tanks, and the thought struck me was they're dancing together. They were just shaken so violently, and you had this sound of tearing metal, and then I was right next to the big garage, and they had about four great big overhead garage doors, and they were trying to jump up and down, and they were trying to jump out.
Hanisch remembers other details, like the smell of dust kicked up as downtown streets buckled and split. He says he'll never forget the sight of Alaska railroad cars slamming into each other as the tracks were torn up by the force of the earthquake, or the sound of fuel tanks being ripped apart. He says one sound will stay in his memory forever.
The power lines, they were just like somebody took a wet rope and was whipping it back and forth.
Hanisch eventually made his way past the electric lines and a stream of spilling gasoline and diesel fuel. He and a friend set out across the shattered remains of West Anchorage. He says he's never been so relieved as he was that evening to find his home, a sturdy log cabin, still standing. Elizabeth Fisher was in her 11th floor apartment during the quake. She, her baby, and her husband huddled together as the building swayed wildly on its foundation. While they were holding on, they discovered an unusual hazard.
The walls moved away from the floor, and it meant we had to jump in order to have a foot cot between the floor and the wall. Of course, I was holding on to the baby, and my husband tried to hold us, the two of us, up, and of course we were thrown back and forth. And luckily, we didn't make it out into the hallway, because the people who were in the hallway were literally rolled back and forth.
Fisher recalls one weird thing about the quake. When it stopped, they had to get down a darkened stairway and were without a flashlight. She says when they opened their apartment door, a large candle rolled up to their feet, and though no one in the family smoked, she found a book of matches in her pocket. Many Alaskans, like Kathy Arnold, were children at the time. She and lots of others remember what they were up to during the quake. They were glued to their TV sets for a kids' show about space travel.
I was watching cartoons, Fireball XL5.
And we're both still wondering how that episode ended. Alaska gets plenty of earthquakes. The big difference with the 1964 quake was its intensity combined with its duration. Donna Grant was in downtown Anchorage. She says the worst was near the end.
The last 30 seconds, things just went to hell. Windows were exploding out in the buildings downtown. Yeah, the street was cracking and sliding away, and it was just, we assumed that everybody across the street had been killed when the street slid down, and they were all screaming, of course. It was just total bedlam.
At least 115 people died during or just after the disaster. Dozens of the fatalities were from tsunamis or tidal waves crashing into coastlines from Alaska to California. Thousands of square miles of the North Pacific Ocean floor were displaced when the earth moved. Grant's thoughts were with her children, who, along with thousands of other students, had the day off from school. Home was miles away, and Grant's car was swallowed when the street broke apart, so she set out to find other transportation.
And I came across the most shaken little old cab driver you ever saw. The whole front of a bank had cascaded down in front of his cab. But anyway, he was ready to get out of town, so I got in. And we went trembling out of town. And as we left, there were people pouring into town volunteers to shut off the gas and put out the fires, and I was always impressed by that.
Anchorage radio stations and ham operators crackled back on the air after being knocked out by the earthquake. Here's what some of the airwaves were carrying that evening in south central Alaska. It came to be called the Good Friday earthquake. One popular story is that of the worshipers at an Anchorage church. The pastor was quoting from the book of Matthew and had just reached the part that says, "And the earth moved," when the chandelier started swinging. The pastor says some of the faithful panicked and ran outside, only to find the ground breaking up. Fortunately, no one in the congregation was lost. And all who remember it say it was miraculous that it didn't hit an hour or two earlier, when the stores were packed with shoppers, or the day before, when schools were in session. As it was, the quake occurred just after 5:30 in the evening, when most people were driving home or already there. In the 25 years since the Alaska quake, the population here has more than doubled. For many of the newcomers, the 1964 earthquake is an interesting bit of history, something you can only imagine when you visit a museum or earthquake park. But for people who lived through it and who still live here, once in a lifetime is more than enough.
You can't imagine the force unless you're in it, and it changes you forever.
Are we worried about an earthquake? We now live on a fault line, and no, we're not worried about it, but just scared to death. I panic whenever there's a new quake.
In Anchorage, I'm Robert Hawk.
And that's Alaska News Nightly for this Monday, March 27th. We had reports tonight from Claire Richardson of KCHU in Valdez, Steve Williams of KHNS in Skagway, and Robert Hawk of KSKA in Anchorage. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Valdez and Peter Kenyon from Juneau. Our Washington correspondent was Joel Southern. Chris Bedalek is our engineer with production assistance from Diana Derby. I'm Corey Flintoff.
Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations, by ARCO Alaska, working to build a strong future for Alaska, by the Sheraton Anchorage, where your comfort and well-being come first, and HB Systems, maker of the HB Systems computer, Valdez, Alaska. This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Good evening, stations. This is the Alaska Public Radio Network Actuality Service for this Monday, the 27th of March. We have three pieces of brand new material for you, and it's material that's obviously been